Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, we are on the air. I'm going to be speaking to former Spider-Man editor, among other things, Glenn Greenberg. Glenn, how are you doing?
Okay, Victor, how are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, we actually sort of know each other from the John Byrne Forum.
Oh, do we?
Yeah, unfortunately, I was executed a couple of years back, but I do remember interacting with you.
Okay, well, I haven't posted there in about 4 years, so I guess I'm what you'd call an inactive member. I haven't terminated my membership, but I haven't participated there in about 4 years now.
Yeah, it's just I always found you very informative, especially in also reading the Life of Riley blog series about the Clone Saga. I always found you very informative about your time at Marvel.
Well, thank you.
All right. I guess the first question to ask me, how did you get into comics?
Well, I've been a fan of them since as far back as I can remember. And when I was around 8 years old, I started writing and drawing my own Marvel comics, mostly the Hulk, because he was my favorite, probably because of the TV show. Batman was my other favorite. But I really sort of tapped into the Hulk, and I started, you know, writing and drawing my own Hulk comic books. And as I moved into college, I decided that writing got done a lot quicker than drawing. So I shifted full-time to writing, and I decided in my senior year of college that I wanted to, you know, give it a try, to try to get into comic books both on the editorial side and hopefully on the writing side. And as a kid, a family friend introduced me to Bob Budiansky, who was a Marvel editor in the early 80s. And in the early 90s, he had moved up to the role of like executive editor of Special Projects. So I gave him a call, and he remembered me from my childhood. I'd stayed in touch with him sporadically over the years, and so he remembered me. And we reestablished our acquaintance. And I'd say within a year or two of me graduating from college, he had an opening in his department, and he called me in for an interview, and I got it. You know, it would be nice to think that my enthusiasm and my talent and my, you know, whatever I brought to the table got me the job. But as with most things, it really depends on knowing somebody. It's very rare that you can just sort of walk into an industry with no experience and get the job. So a lot of it was the fact that Bob Budiansky knew me from when I was a kid, and he was willing to take a chance on me.
Now, what were your responsibilities when you were editing?
Well, they changed over time. I mean, when I started, I was an assistant editor, so I was working for Bob, and then I worked for Tom Brevoort, and we started out working on the trading cards. If you remember, the trading cards were a very big deal back in the early 90s. It was a big fad, a craze. And Marvel was producing trading cards. I got to work on the Joe Jusko Marvel Masterpieces series. That was the first thing I worked on. So every few days or weeks, you know, Joe Jusko would come in with new paintings that we would turn into trading cards. And so, you know, it was a great way to get started, you know, working with Joe Jusko. Over time, Tom and I started moving over to, you know, the comic books. And so we were working on Night Thrasher and Nova, New Warriors, and little by little we started moving, you know, into the Spider-Man group, to the point where, you know, we launched and handled every issue of Untold Tales of Spider-Man and various Spider-Man special projects, limited series, one shots. And then we started working on some various other, you know, non-Spider-Man related projects. And over time, you know, I eventually got promoted and got my own books. So I was doing Marvel Team-Up, I was doing I did Superman versus the Incredible Hulk versus Superman, just to get the title accurate. It was the Incredible Hulk versus Superman because Marvel was the one that handled the production end of that book. I came up with it. I selected the creative team, so I handled that. I was editing X-Men, which was my one sole X-Men book. And I had a lot of other stuff in the pipeline at the time that I left the company. So it was a bunch of various different things that I handled as an editor.
All right. Let me go back. You mentioned that working on Night Thrasher Nova. Now, the New Warriors kind of had their own little network of books. How did that compare to, say, the Spider-Man books? How in sync were the Warriors line of books?
Well, by the time that we got them, Night Thrasher and Nova were both on the cancellation block. So to answer your question, not much in terms of my experience, because by the time we got Night Thrasher, it was like the last couple of issues, and Nova was canceled, you know, pretty abruptly when it was handed to us. So the only book of that group that we had ongoing was New Warriors. And pretty much the day we got the book, the regular writer, Fabian Nicieza, had told us he was planning on leaving. So we had to find a new writer. We had to find a new artist. And we kept it going. If I remember correctly, we kept it going for about a year or so. And I think we did some really good stuff on it. I remember being pretty pleased with the stuff we were doing. And as I recall, the book was canceled not so much because of the sales, but because we got a new editor-in-chief who just, you know, really had no love for the book and was looking kind of like for any excuse to get rid of it.
All right. Now, you mentioned also when you'd be in charge of a limited series, how would a creative team come about? Would you ask the writer if they wanted to do it, or could the people make pitches to you?
It mostly was generated in-house. It was mostly generated in-house. We would be handed a project. You know, maybe the editor-in-chief would come up with the project, or I would suggest the project, and we would try to decide who the best writer would be, who the best artist would be, and we would go to them. We didn't really take a lot of pitches from freelancers. Occasionally we would. I mean, it was very much a case-by-case basis, but I would say the majority of the projects that we worked on were generated in-house. You know, like Spider-Man Legacy of Evil, which was the history of the Green Goblin. That was something that was suggested, I think, by Bob Budiansky, who at the time was running the Spider-Man department. And, you know, we had to figure out, you know, who would be the best writer for that. And at the time, Kurt Busiek was on the rise, and he knew history of the Marvel Universe so well that he was a logical person to pitch it to. I don't know if he was our first choice. I don't remember if he was our first choice, but he certainly was in the top two or top three. And we knew we wanted to do more painted projects because Marvel's had been such a big hit. And so painted projects became, you know, the big craze, because in the wake of Marvel's, there was Kingdom Come. So Marvel wanted to, you know, get more in on that. So Mark Texera, who had become a very notable painter of comic-style stuff at the time, he was somebody that we really zeroed in on. But, I mean, and Kurt, I mean, when we gave the project to Kurt, he came up with the story. I mean, we didn't feed him the story at all. It was his story, his ideas, and so forth. But I think, you know, we probably went to him and said something along the lines of, hey, we've got this idea, we want to do the history of the Green Goblin. What do you think? And he agreed to do it, and took it from there.
Okay. You also mentioned doing Incredible Hulk versus Superman. Now, how much freedom did Roger Stern have to create the story for that? Because, you know, I understand that when you do these intercompany crossovers that you're not, you know, there's a lot of politics involved in it.
Okay. Well, that's a long story. I'll try to make it as short as possible. But the genesis of the story was I wanted to do the Incredible Hulk versus Superman, because at the time Marvel and DC were doing a lot of crossovers, and I know that Superman and the Hulk had crossed paths before, but I wanted to do an old fashioned traditional Marvel DC crossover, just the two of them. And the idea that I had was Stan Lee writing it. He had never written Superman before. This would have brought a lot of cachet to the project, and it would have been very exciting, I think, for everybody. So that was the original concept, and that was the concept that I took to DC. Well, DC, the thought of Stan Lee writing a story involving Superman, they loved it. So they signed off on it right away. The trick was who was going to draw it, and my first and only choice was Steve Rude. And Steve had been resistant to doing anything for Marvel for many years. He thought that Marvel was, you know, basically, you know, the great white Satan kind of thing, because, you know, he felt that we had treated the creators, particularly Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, very, very poorly. Now, obviously, I had nothing to do with any of that, so I wanted to kind of stay out of that kind of thing. I just wanted to work with Steve Rude. I was a big fan of his stuff. And he and I had established a relationship to the point where I could call him, and we would talk and, you know, chew the fat and have great conversations. But every time I'd offer him a project, he would turn it down. But by the time we had gotten to Hulk versus Superman, he and I had established enough of a rapport that he was intrigued, and when I told him that Stan Lee was in the pipeline to write it, he couldn't turn it down. The concept of working with Stan Lee was so overwhelming to Steve that he signed on. So Stan and I talked a lot, and the idea was Stan was going to plot it, and Stan was going to script it, and it was great. Everybody was excited about it, but with each subsequent conversation I'd have with Stan, you could see that he was starting to get cold feet, to the point where he said to me he would want somebody to plot it for him, and then he would script it. And I wasn't comfortable with that, and I don't think anybody who I would approach to plot it would have been comfortable with that, because, you know, you're hired to write the story for Superman versus the Hulk, or excuse me, the Hulk versus Superman. You want to do the scripting yourself. You know, you don't want to come up with all the, you know, come up with the story, do all the legwork, have Steve Rude, you know, draw your story so beautifully, and then you don't get to the finish line, you know, so to speak. You don't get to script the artwork that Steve is drawing based on your story. So I didn't feel comfortable going to another writer and basically having them do the plot. So I was going to cancel the whole thing. And Steve Rude was so into it at that point that he basically kept, you know, kept the spirit alive, to the point where, you know, he kept on, like, you know, badgering me to, you know, keep it going, get it going. Come on, let's get the wheels turning. So I finally kind of thought about who had enough experience writing Superman and the Hulk that they would be a writer that both companies would be comfortable with. And the answer was obvious: Roger Stern. Roger had written... Sorry?
No, I was agreeing with you.
Oh, okay. Roger had written Superman during one of the real golden periods of the character. And he'd also written a very, very popular, memorable, and somewhat groundbreaking run on the Hulk. So I went back to DC and said, look, Stan's not going to work out. Steve Rude is still on board, but Stan's not going to work out. What do you guys think of Roger Stern? And they were fine with it. They were absolutely fine with it. And so that's how we got going. In terms of the politics, I would say DC had nothing to be too concerned about, because in addition to, you know, their character being very well served by Roger and illustrated by Steve, the only, if you remember, if you read the book, the only supervillain in the story is DC's character, Lex Luthor, you know? And so DC kind of came out maybe like a half a step ahead of us in that regard. I think, you know, my original idea was, you know, there would be a Superman villain and there would be a Hulk villain. And when Roger came back with the plot, I kind of like was like looking at it and was like, you know, you know, DC has one, you know, a leg up on us because, you know, there's no Marvel villain represented here. But the story worked so well and, you know, it flowed so nicely. And you know, given the amount of pages that we had, I think it was a 48-page book, you know, I didn't want to, like, take away from, the you know, the story that Roger had written to kind of shoehorn in, I don't know, the leader or the Metal Master or whoever, you know, whatever Hulk villain we could have shoved in there. And so if memory serves, and I could be wrong about this, but my memory is that it is the first and only DC Marvel crossover where Marvel didn't, like, have, you know, a, sort of like equality in terms of the characters represented. You know, DC had their arch villain, but we didn't. But nobody complained about it. I mean, nobody even I think noticed it, and it worked out really well. And so, in terms of the politics, yeah, I mean, there were a couple of things that, you know, DC was concerned about quality control, and you know, they had some quibbles about the way Steve was drawing Superman. They wanted the S to be bigger and stuff like that. But as I recall, it went pretty darn smoothly.
Okay. Pardon me. Now, those the thing that I remember about that crossover, because I have a copy of it in my closet, which means I probably can't get to it anytime soon. But the thing I remember was it was the first Superman-Hulk crossover that felt really satisfying. Because
okay.
The other one, they kind of left you wanting, because the first one in the Spider-Man-Hulk crossover where Superman just kind of, I don't know, kind of toyed with the Hulk. And then you had the one in DC versus Marvel where it was kind of the Peter David Hulk, which is not quite the, you know, the iconic Hulk you think of.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, and this is no slight on Peter or any of the people who worked on DC Marvel. I didn't really count that as a real kind of thing because Superman had the mullet, and the Hulk was you know, the Peter David merged Hulk, and so it really wasn't it was neither iconic version. And so when I think of, you know, any kind of, you know, other encounters between the two characters, the only one that really comes to mind is the one that was in that the second Superman Spider-Man crossover that was done by Jim Shooter and John Buscema.
Now, one thing I want to ask about is, because I'm just asking about because I don't want to forget it, because I think as a comic book writer, I think probably your biggest contribution was to Norman Osborn.
Okay.
You know, because you added a lot of stuff to the mythos of it, you know, to the point that I still used to think about the healing factor, because I think you're a Dallas fan, you know, they killed off J.R. Ewing this year, and I kept telling my friend, I said, we'll just wait for the Goblin Serum to kick in and he'll be alive again.
I wish.
I know, that's what I guess. How does that come about?
What specifically? The healing factor?
The Osborn Journal in general.
Well, Marvel was, you know, pretty much, you know, I can't remember if we were in bankruptcy yet at that point, but we certainly were not doing well. And so we would kind of flood the market, to put it delicately. We would kind of flood the market with stuff at the end of the year. And we were wrapping up the Clone Saga. This was, I guess, late 96. We were wrapping up the Clone Saga. And somebody, probably our vice president in charge of publishing, just put on the schedule a book to come out in December called Spider-Man: The Osborn Journal. And nobody had a concept for it. Nobody knew what it was. It was just something that was put on the schedule and something that was, you know, expected to come out in December, which would have been 2 months after the Clone Saga ended, because the Clone Saga ended at the end of October. And I remember asking the Spider-Man editor at the time, Ralph Macchio, I said, Ralph, what's Spider-Man: The Osborn Journal going to be? And Ralph said, Glenn, I have no idea. And I said, I know what I think it should be. And he said, what? And I said, well, remember those issues of the Tomb of Dracula? Every now and then, Marv Wolfman in Tomb of Dracula would do a story where it was told from Dracula's point of view. Dracula is writing in his journal, and he would tell these vignettes of experiences that he had over the years and encounters that he had, and it would be told from Dracula's point of view. So you really sort of get an insight into his personality, his the way he sees the world, and how he views, you know, people and events. And I said, you know, that's what the Osborne Journal should be. I mean, we had already established, you know, years in the past, I guess Roger Stern had established it when he created the Hobgoblin, that Norman Osborne had left behind these various journals. And I said, well, this should be Norman's journal writing about how involved he was in the Clone Saga. His, you know, basically summing up the Clone Saga from his point of view. And Ralph said, that sounds like a great idea, Glenn. Why don't you write it? And I said, nah. I said, you know who you should get to write it is Kurt Busiek, who had already written Legacy of Evil. And I said, he's the guy you should get to write it. You should get more of an A-list writer than me. And apparently Ralph went to Kurt. Kurt wasn't interested because he felt like he'd said everything he wanted to say with the Green Goblin. And so Ralph came back to me and said, I asked Kurt. He said no. Please do it. So I did it. And what I did was I went through, I guess at the time was going to be about 20, 25 years worth of Spider-Man history, and just tried to, you know, reconcile the stuff that was going on in the books, how it could relate to the Clone Saga, the overall Clone Saga, and reconcile all that with the notion that Norman Osborn had been alive all that time, you know, pulling strings and arranging for things to happen exactly the way he wanted to. But I also had to deal with stuff like, well, why didn't Norman do this if he was still alive? And why didn't Norman do that if he was still alive? And I had to reconcile all that and come up with rationalizations for why he didn't, you know, step in sooner or take a more active role. You know, I originally wanted it, you know, that the reason why Norman was not on the scene much sooner if he was alive all that time was that he physically couldn't be, that his supposed death after the death of Gwen Stacy had so incapacitated him while he was healing that it basically took him 5 years to get back, you know, back to where he had been. And so the reason why he didn't take an active role and kind of let Harry become the Green Goblin, and why he didn't step in to, you know, to stop the Hobgoblin when the Hobgoblin first appeared, is he physically was incapable of doing so. That was my original idea. That got shot down by the editor-in-chief. So I had to really sort of come up with this rationale for, okay, why didn't he? You know, why did he go to Europe? Why did he stay in Europe? Why didn't he come back to New York and step in and, you know, basically, you know, punish the Hobgoblin for stealing his journals and basically stealing his gig? And so, you know, it forced me to be a little bit more creative and a little bit more, you know, delve a little bit more deeply into Norman's psyche and, quite frankly, come up with stuff for Norman's psyche that really didn't exist before. You know, it's funny because, you know, I remember being at the Spider-Man writing conferences, and, you know, Tom DeFalco, who, you know, is second to none in terms of his knowledge of Spider-Man. I mean, he's right up there with Roger and Stan. You know, he just could not buy the fact that Norman was in Europe basically pulling the strings from afar. I mean, you know, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but Tom's argument was Norman Osborn is not the man in the shadows. Norman Osborn is a guy who works out his problems by putting on a Green Goblin suit and flying over the city, you know, and committing crimes and, you know, trying to kill Spider-Man. You know, Norman is a take charge kind of guy. He's not a master manipulator. And I agreed with him. The editor-in-chief did not. And so this was the direction that we had to go in. And sort of, I kind of wrote it through somewhat gritted teeth, But, you know, the fact that a lot of readers kind of, you know, warmed up to it and embraced it, you know, I guess I was convincing enough in my writing to make people buy it, even if, you know, an expert like, you know, DeFalco, you know, kind of, you know, didn't buy it.
Okay. Well, here's something I was wondering about. Do you think the fact that Norman actually got impaled, do you think that would have had a psychological effect, you know? Because that seems to me like something serious enough, you know, and actually sort of going through the process of death and, you know, coming back, you know, it seems like that'd be the type of thing that might change the way you operate a lot.
Well, I do. And I think that that was probably what was going through my head when I was writing it because, you know, I think my rationale was Norman had never been beaten so badly. He had never come so close to death before. You know, the other times that he, you know, was operating as the goblin, you know, it always ended with him hitting his head and getting amnesia and turning back into, you know, Norman and, you know, forgetting everything. So this time, I mean, he'd come closer to death and essentially had died, you know, like never before. And it did, you know, the way that I saw it was, you know, he came to the realization that the world thinks that he's dead. He can operate even more freely now, you know. You know, the big difference here was when he sort of emerged from this defeat, he still had all of his memories intact. So, you know, I mean, if the world knew that he was still alive, if Spider-Man knew that he was still alive, Spider-Man would just come after him, especially after what he did to Gwen. So being able to operate sort of underground, he could shift his focus and shift his standard operating procedure and come at Spider-Man from a completely different way. I'm sure that this was going through my head as I was writing the journal. And, you know, plus the fact that he encountered the cult of the Scryers, and they looked like ghosts, I think kind of inspired him that, you know, from now on, I'm going to be a ghost. Until the time is right for me to reemerge and rejoin the land of the living, I am basically going to function as a ghost. And I think you really hit upon a very valid point there, is that his near-death experience or his death experience, whatever you want to call it, did have an effect on him and made him change the way he was operating.
Now, one thing I want to ask about is because while I've got you here is because I know you're a big fan of Star Trek, and eventually Marvel got the Star Trek license. First thing I want to ask is, do you know why DC lost the license?
Why DC lost the license? Well, I think probably some of it had to do with sales. I think that the sales were not justifying the price that they were paying for the license. I also think to a large extent DC lost interest. I mean, if you look at the last 6 months to a year of the DC Star Trek books, you know, they weren't exactly, you know, the high point of those runs. You know, DC on the original series, the Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock series, you know, they were getting some, you know, kind of really amateurish art, very, you know, with real, you know, really newcomers and newcomer artists that really weren't seasoned yet. I remember, you know, one of the artists was like, I think she had been a courtroom artist, you know, before she got the gig. So she didn't really have any experience in comics, and they weren't really getting, you know, not even A-list artists. They weren't even getting B-list artists to draw the books. The writing was all over the place. I just think that they had lost interest. They weren't really committed to the books anymore. And I think Paramount probably, you know, picked up on that as well. And this is all supposition on my part. I would probably say that sales had more to do with it than anything, and they just kind of let the contract run out. And so I think that's what happened.
Over the years, you know, I've never been a huge Star Trek. I've been kind of a casual Star Trek fan. Like, I remember watching Deep Space Nine at like 5 a.m. usually most mornings, but I remember reading some of these comics, you know, and I thought they were really good. They seem to be a lot more dynamic than some of the DC ones. And I can't remember this number, what issue was exactly. Did you write the issue of the comic that
No, I never wrote the Deep. Are you talking about Deep Space Nine?
No, the Marvel comic, just the regular Marvel Star Trek. There was one issue of the comic that used the Gorn.
No, I never got to use the Gorn.
How did you view when you finally got the chance to write the comics? Were you more nervous than you would have been before you'd written something like Spider-Man?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, in the script I wrote for my first issue of my first Star Trek comic, I literally wrote a note to the editor and the artist saying, "Somebody pinch me," you know. I mean, to sit down and write, you know, and know that you're going to get paid for this, to write, you know, Captain Kirk walks onto the bridge of the Enterprise, and then you start and you write your first line of, you know, dialogue that you're going to have Captain Kirk say. It's a pretty heady experience, and so absolutely I was, you know, nervous, intimidated, overwhelmed. It was a very unique experience. I would say more so than I felt when I wrote my first Spider-Man story, when I wrote my first Hulk story. Absolutely.
Let me ask you a whole question. I'm sorry if I go back and forth. I try not to have a timeline list because I find, you know, for the listeners and probably the guests, it gets a little boring. So
yeah.
I try to kind of mix up the order. Let me ask you a question about Hulk that I've always had. How mad do you think Bruce Banner needs to be to turn into the Hulk? Can it be like he stubs his toe and like, oh, shit, or would it have to be some epic level of anger?
You know, it's funny you ask that because that's something that I've thought about a lot over the years, and it's funny because I just recently finished watching the TV series with my 10-year-old daughter, and it was so inconsistent on that show and in the comics too in terms of what would trigger the change. I mean, there were episodes where Banner was getting, you know, I mean, beaten up like you would not believe, thrown into walls and kicked and pummeled, and he's not changing. And I remember there was one episode where my daughter and I were just like yelling at the TV screen, "Change already!" You know. Finally, you see the eyes turn white. You know, I don't know. I don't think the writers ever really knew. I think in those particular cases they let the plot dictate, and that's never a good thing. You know, you should always, you know, let the characters dictate how the story goes. And, you know, it was always unclear what triggered the change back from the Hulk to Banner. I remember there were issues in the 70s where it would be issue after issue of the Hulk, you know, and there would be these moments where he would sit down and he would be like, you know, playing with a little doggy or a deer would come over and he would pet the deer and say, you know, "Oh, dear Hulk friend," you know. Well, why isn't he changing back? He's calm. He's at peace. You know, you would think that would be, you know, enough to trigger the change back. And so I don't know if anybody ever really had it figured out. What I tried to do, you know, was just, you know, at least from my own stories, was, you know, have it be, it gets to the point where, you know, stubbing your toe, maybe not. But if you get to the point where you can't think clearly, where you get so angry. I mean, have you ever reached the point where you've gotten so angry, like, you can't even, like, string a sentence together?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would say that. Well, I would say that's the point where the eyes start turning white or green or however they portray it nowadays. But, you know, when he gets so angry that he can't even think clearly, where your mind just becomes chaotic, where your thoughts become chaotic, that should be where the change occurs. Because, you know, if it gets to the point where he turns into the Hulk when he stubs his toe, I mean, that gets kind of ridiculous, you know. I thought that the Avengers movie played it very well. I thought that the Incredible Hulk movie with Edward Norton played it very well. You know, the two or three times that he changes in the Norton movie, you know, I guess the first time is he's getting beaten up, which was, you know, very much like the TV series. And then the next one was they're shooting tear gas or knockout gas into that bridge that he's on. And he sees the soldiers are manhandling Betty. I mean, that's when he sees them roughing up Betty to get her out of there, that was what triggered the change. They were roughing up the woman that he loves. I mean, that's enough, you know. And then, of course, when he throws himself out of a plane, you know. You know, I mean, that's and if you remember, did you see the movie?
Yeah, I saw the 08 movie. Yeah.
Okay. You know, and if you remember, it's not until right about the time when he hits the ground that he really, you know, starts to change. So, you know, I liked all that. I liked that you know, it's not, you know, getting a paper cut that's gonna cause the change. And I thought that they played it really well in the Avengers movie, too. So I would lean more towards that. At this point, I'm following the current Hulk series by Mark Waid. I don't think we know enough about how it operates to sort of make a clear determination on what triggers the change and what triggers the change back. The Hulk hasn't been fully developed as a character in this current incarnation. So I don't know, you know, how Mark Waid sees it. I can only know how I see it and how I think it should be done.
You know, it's an interesting thing when you mentioned about when Banner's being beaten, and I have this belief because, you know, I get it. I've been in a fight once or twice, you know, like a couple of months ago, some meth head sucker punched me, and I had this thing, you know, where it was weird. I didn't get angry until it was over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're in shock.
Like, it was weird. Right, I got hit, and I was like, wait, did this guy just hit me? Yeah,
exactly.
Dude, I'm pretty sure he hit you. Oh, I better
you're in shock. And it's funny, do you know about the Jim Shooter Hulk story?
Yes.
You know which one I'm talking about, right?
Yes, definitely, because I was actually telling my friend about that the other day.
Okay. Now, Jim told me that, you know, what you just explained, what you just described, is similar to what he wanted Banner to experience in that story. Now, if you remember, Banner was living in a YMCA, and two homosexual guys try to attack him. And he doesn't change until after he's escaped from them. Right? Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. What Jim was telling me was that was basically what he was trying to convey, is that when he was so almost like supernaturally calm and rational as it was happening, because he couldn't believe that it was happening. And it was only after he escaped, where he had a moment to sort of reflect on what these guys were going to do to him, that he got angry and repulsed and disgusted, and that's what, you know, caused him to change. I know a lot of people don't buy it. A lot of writers that I've spoken to don't buy it and just think it was, like, you know, bad writing or you know, very plot-driven, very convenient. But I know where Jim was coming from that. So it was just interesting that you brought that up.
Well, I think if the attack had happened, then definitely he would have changed at that point. Of course, I was telling a friend, I said, man, would that be a horrible horrible experience to have that transformation happen right then.
Right, for both parties.
I was just picturing like the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, could you imagine? And then the guy turns into the Hulk?
Yeah, it's like, I don't...
Or like,
you
know, an episode
right
of Oz.
Yeah, it's like they took it in some strange new directions.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, unfortunately, I don't have too much time left because we covered so much, but I was going to tell you about, I was going to ask you about Hobgoblin Lives.
Sure.
How does that come about?
That was me.
He says
very modestly. In a nutshell, we were looking for new Spider-Man projects to do in the wake of the Clone Saga. Again, it was a matter of just sort of, you know, putting out supplemental Spider-Man material because Spider-Man was still selling well enough that we knew that we wanted to, you know, do more Spider-Man stuff. And I had been lobbying for a long time to get Roger Stern back to do Spider-Man. He had resisted for years because it was never the right thing. And I knew that he wanted to come back and finish up the Hobgoblin story the way he originally intended it, and he was of the firm opinion that the Spider-Man story, the Hobgoblin story that Peter David had written that wrapped up the whole thing, could you could still go back and do it the way he originally intended and not sort of undo what Peter had done in his story. So I knew that that would be the carrot to bring Roger back. And so I called Roger, asked him if he would be interested. He was interested. I went to the editor-in-chief and asked him, would Marvel be interested? He said, get Roger to tell you who the Hobgoblin is. I want to know who the Hobgoblin is because I don't want to commit to this otherwise. I went back. I asked Roger, okay, who did you have in mind to be the Hobgoblin, and how does it work? I swear to you, I will not tell anybody but the editor-in-chief. So Roger confided in me, the whole Roderick Kingsley thing with the brother and blah, 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 blah. And so I went back to the editor-in-chief. I explained to him the whole Roderick Kingsley thing, how it would work, how it would be established, how it would all be explained away. And the editor-in-chief, to his credit, said, okay, go ahead and do it. And so at that point, I just said, Roger, it's all yours. And we worked out the format, so it would be 3 issues, 32 pages each, so he'd have a lot of room to flesh out the story, no ads. And, John Romita Jr. was not available to us, so I went with the next, guy who made, the most contributions to the Hobgoblin, which was Ron Frenz, who luckily was able and willing to do it. And we got a cast of A-list characters for Inkers. And
yeah,
that was it. It was really I generated the idea of doing the project, but from that point on, Roger was in the driver's seat.
That first issue with George Perez inking Ron Frenz, and I love Ron Frenz's art. I mean, he is one of my favorites, but when George Perez was inking him, that was like some of the most beautiful art I've ever seen in a Spider-Man comic.
I agree with you, and I wish George was able to do the whole series, but he had to back out when we began number two.
All right. Glenn, I tell you, we've only got like 3 minutes left, and I don't want to get you involved in a story and have you get cut off, because there's still a lot of stuff, because I'd love to ask you about Goblins at the Gate. Maybe we can get together again.
I would love to. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. We'll try to schedule something, and I think that's the first – I don't think I have another show scheduled next week. Glenn, thank you for joining us. I just don't want you to get cut off is all.
Well, if you ask me like two yes or no questions, we can probably fit those in 3 minutes.
Yeah, because I want to ask you about – I tell you, if I have time, I'll be able to read that Dracula miniseries you did.
Oh, I'd love to talk about that. That was a dream project of mine.
All right, Glenn, you have a good afternoon, and I will talk to you again.
You too. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You too.
And all right, bye-bye.
We'll be back on Tuesday. I'll be back on Tuesday with Neil and Mike, and we will just be discussing things like Dallas and what have you. All right, good afternoon, everybody.